they couldn't supply this Postforce driver on their product. So we at SUSE had we had this driver update process where we provided means so that you could download the driver from the website of the from API, but we couldn't ship it with our product. Basically, due to the fact that it loaded the kernel module, which was closed source, into a GPL kernel, which violates the GPL, so we would have been in big trouble if we had provided it in our CDs or whatever. And so it was kind of dissatisfactory for both sides, consumer users, and also for Linux distributions. And both sides put pressure put pressure on API to change the situation. Now, users usually are very vocal in public and express their dissatisfaction about the situation publicly. Now, Linux distributors, mostly technical partners of API, they don't give the public advice to their partners, but behind closed doors, of course, there were discussions going on. So well, another thing that appeared, last year, was the Vivo driver, a project where, well, some people in this room were involved in. Daniel Stone. Daniel? Where's Daniel?
He's still
there. Oh, okay. Jerome? Jerome in here? Ah, there's Jerome. Yeah. It was the attempt, pretty successful attempt even to reverse engineer what the closed-source catalyst driver and the BIOS does to initialize the hardware. So it was basically a mode-setting driver that helped to overcome this this problem. And it also was kind of serving as a means to put some pressure on the API by telling them, well, we're doing something we don't need. Necessarily didn't need information, so we can do our own driver. This was aimed at hardware that could only at the time, and when the R6XX generation came out, there was virtually nothing. There was no driver that could deal with it. There was no open source driver, in sight. And also the Catalyst driver, at the time of the release of the hardware, the closed source proprietary driver from ATI was not able to support this hardware under Linux. It supported it under Windows, of course, but not under Linux at the time when the hardware was released. That was kind of also for AMD, the company that purchased ATI, a way to look into this situation. AMD actually had a very long history with open source drivers and supporting the community in writing drivers for AMD hardware. So there was a different AMD had different paradigms, and so this kind of helped to change the entire situation. We at SUSE have a long history of good relationships with AMD because we kind of started with the x86-64 project. We did the port of Linux to x86-64, which was a very successful product. And since then, we have a pretty close relationship to AMD. So AMD came to us and asked us, what our ideas were to create an open source driver here. So three of us, Matthias, Luke, and me got together and put together a proposal how this could be done. Different steps involved there. aim there was to have community involvement early on, so release something pretty soon once the first bits are there. Somebody would have to do the first bits and then go and share them, and so that people can jump in. That one. Another thing that we asked for was that documentation for the chipset is available to everybody very early on. Oops, I should have put it in the presentation mode. Press the button sometimes. Without any strings attached. There used to be, at a certain time, there used to be a program for open source developers where they could sign an NDA to get documentation from API. I think this is kind of messy for both sides. API needs to keep track of the of this, and actually we didn't want, we wanted to avoid this. So this was our proposal, and then AMD asked us to jumpstart a driver, create an initial driver that can then be released to the public together with an initial set of documentation. So in, I think it was around July, mid-July, we got the first drop of documentation from ATI, which at that time was still under NDA because it required some cleanup or needed to be looked over. And we started to write this driver. Okay, so before I talk about the details of the driver, I think John also already had a transparency on this, so I can be really brief on this. Yeah, John has a diagram of the different components and he, that are involved in graphics. And he had three components outlined. One was the driver inside the X server. Currently, the X server contains the driver that is basically the mode settings, which does 2D acceleration. We have two different architectures in the X server right now. One is the old X386 acceleration architecture, which, now there's Daniel, one of the people involved in the Vivo.
Oh, what?
Which has been around for, even before X86 4.0 was released. So it's pretty old. Basically, it accelerates the 4X protocol. There's not much, or pretty much nothing, to accelerate any new functionalities, any new rendering functionalities like in the XRender extension. Then we have EXA, which is a little newer, and supposed to help to accelerate render. It doesn't do so much acceleration of the core protocol anymore because this is not that often used anymore. So a lot of drivers support both architectures because XAA is considered the more stable, more reliable one. XA the more experimental one. And in many benchmarks, if you see benchmark results, you still see that XAA is still a little faster than XA. I'm going to go into the details so much on this. So I think John went into this already. We can do this random hardware. We can do this either through classical MMC programming or using the command processor. Another thing that the X driver does is set up the DRM. Basically, it does currently. This is the credit model. Actually, we are looking into a new model using a kernel-based memory manager. At the moment, the X server is still in charge of allocating memory buffers. All this allocation is very static. If all this is done inside the X driver. Another thing that the X driver does is context switching between 2D and 3D applications, because you need to have a different hardware state, and this is also done in the X driver. Well, another thing that's classically been done in the X server is to program video overlay scaler to support X video. Now, this is something that we don't or can't do anymore on radio and HD, but we'll get to this later. Well, the part is a kernel module, the DRM module, which basically submits demand buffers to the hardware. Does hopefully not all do this. There's some basic command checking so that no illegal commands get sent to the hardware, because once you can do this, you can have the graphic chip do all kinds of wacky things on your hardware. And it also takes care of interrupt handling. The third piece is actually the DRI client-side module. It's a sub-module that gets loaded by the libgl when you run a 3D application. It pretty much converts the OpenGL state to hardware-specific commands. And today with Scalar, contains the backends of assemblers and, not scalers, shaders, contains the backends assemblers and compilers for those shaders. So, here, to understand the next slide a little bit better, I used a graphic that I picked up the API website. I hope this is okay, John. I'm using this graphic. It's not very detailed, not completely accurate. It describes most of the parts that we have been programming in the radio and HD driver so far. So, just to give an overview, there's some parts missing. Well, here you would have first the memory sequencer or the surface engine, which reads out video data. Here's scan line data from the frame buffer. And also the CRT controllers, which provide the timing information, provide the timing signals, and are driven by the PLLs for the pixel clock is also not in here. The data that comes out of there gets then fed through the display pipeline. The gamma correction, color correction, this is what we do in the color lookup table. Then further down the pipeline you have a scaler which can rescale the image if your screen, like on laptops, has a different physical size than the image of the frame buffer you want to view. The scaler engine. Now here is something drawn in. There's the video overlay engine. This is something which we will probably not use ever, because the overlay engine does not, at least on R5XX and R6X, does not have a scaler anymore. So you could overlay video data in YCRCB and some YCRCB cars this format, but you can't really scale it to the size you want it. So whatever video you would have, you have in the original size. So this part is probably never going to be used. Further down is an output crossbar, which we have two independent CRTCs and two independent memory sequencers, so we can have two sets of data from your framework running for the display engine. And here in the crossbar, it gets distributed on the different outputs. Now, today, on if you look at your video card, unless you have two jacks on the back, oftentimes they're both DVI jacks. Most of them depends on most of DVI jacks provides two signals, one analog signal for the old monitors with connector like this. There is an adapter which you can plug on here. And also a digital signal for digital panels, mostly digital monitors. So you have analog DAC outputs for normal CRTCs, or analog input monitors, digital outputs for DVI, CMDS outputs. You have, it's not on here, you have LVDS for panels, flat panels on laptops. And also you have television. Most cars, I think most ADI cars today have TV out. So all these different kind of outputs and how these two signals are fed to these outputs is controlled by a crossbar. Actually, here's a TV encoder which when you hook up a TV does some funky rescaling of the data so it fits your TV norm. Actually, we don't have much documentation on this part, or not any documentation at all, so this is pretty much a black box for us. So the picture is not completely accurate. It seems to be that you can assign this to both stacks. Okay, there we are. So, what's the present status of our Radeon HD driver? Well, we can pretty much do full mode setting. We can support most of the outputs. Our TV out is not completely done yet. We've got most of the pieces coded up, but we can't control the TV out, the TV controller you've seen on the previous slide yet. We will be able to control this probably through AdaVise. I will come back to this on a later slide. Not all the pieces for this are in place yet. We can drive all kinds of digital outputs. We can drive DVI. We can drive panels. We have support for XRNR 1.2. Pretty much standard today. We have support for XAA, both XAA and XA, at least for our 5XX. You've probably heard from John's talk that on our 6XX, or any later generation after our 5XX, the dedicated 2D engine is gone. Instead, you would have to use the 3D engine. Now there's emulation in later, in the later hardware, which pretty much emulates the 2D engine, but this needs to be initialized, so the state needs to be set, and the code for this is not yet in the driver, so we don't have that yet. I expect, the code for this will probably be in the T-Core that's going to be released, so we can plug it up there and do 2D acceleration also for our 6XX. What we've done in the driver very early on, we looked at the different subsystems we've seen on the previous slide, we separated them out in software. I mean, if you look at the older text drivers, everything was somehow clumped together and was just a huge pile of mess, because the original 10 of X drivers usually, or the design that's been used was just for one single output per card. So the first step, what we did, we separated off, or wrote separate subsystems for all the different hardware pieces, separate systems for the PLLs, for the PRCCs, the surface engine, the sequencer, that reads the data from the frame buffer, for color transformation, for the outputs. We separated all of them, the DACs for analog, the LVDS for panels, and the TMDS for DVI and HDMI. We also have support to abstract out the connectors, the physical connectors, because if you have a situation where you have separate different outputs connected to one connector, this is the case on the DVI dual, where you have an analog and TMDS on one connector. But you can also have another thing you can have, one output shares several connectors, which is the case between analog VGA connectors and TVOs. They usually use the same DAC. So an abstraction layer, to have an abstraction of connectors here is very helpful. From there, using this separation and abstraction of the different subsystems, we looked into how to map this onto XRNR 1.2. So we didn't go and into XRNR 1.2 and try to map the hardware correctly. We first separated out everything nicely in software, and then checked how we can interface this into the abstraction model of the XRNR 1.2 extension, or XRNR 1.2 mode setting system. This kind of helps because whenever new engines or whenever new hardware comes around which changes any of these subsystems, it's very easy to plug this in. And also, the hardest thing in driver development, especially in graphics driver development, is to get the bit banding right, especially when your documentation kind of sucks. Writing up those pieces is probably the biggest work. The infrastructure on top is also a lot of work, but it doesn't change that much. There are not that many generations, hopefully. So it's a good idea to have those pieces reusable. So when you change to another environment, you can carry those along, so it's kind of nice to have them abstracted out. A lot of the old drivers don't have this, which makes it very painful to adapt to new models. Like when R1 and 2 came along, take one of the really old drivers, it's really painful to pluck things apart and stick them back together so that it fits R1 and 2. So we abstracted out these things very much from the beginning, so that we are very flexible here. Well, another thing, now, of course, not a big deal, cursor engine, support for I2RC to read out EDC from the display. This is all separated out in different subsystems. Also, we added software abstraction for monitors. Now, something like this is also part in XRNR 1.2. We found that we needed to do some more and some different validations than XRNR 1.2, so we put a layer on top of this. But this is completely a software abstraction. Another thing, we have a John talked about it already. We'll have to talk about this on a later slide too. We have a layer for atom bias that deals with the bias calls and data tables and bias. So this separation really proved to be very useful, very flexible. So the integration of RNR1.2 proved to be very simple. Now, our initial driver didn't support RNR1.2 right from the outset because we first wanted to get all these different submodules right, and we just plugged them together somehow hard coded to get some modes up to speed how this works. And later on, we integrated this into the RNR1.2 model. So, also, the design is very portable, so we neatly separated between driver private parts and hardware-related functions and interfaces to the other parts of the X server into the device depends on the EDX card or even the calls from directly from DIX, from the device independent layer of the X server.
So you can find the components of the DIX.
Sorry?
You're finding the support for EDX into the DIX rather than the X
server? Possible. There was somebody asking just a few days ago on the mailing list if it was possible to port the driver to what was the operating system called? Zilpo or something? Yeah. It's currently another open source operating system I've never heard of. And I think if you take all the bitbank pieces out, you can take them, port them over to a completely different environment. And also, whatever you do, you can, people talk about kernel mode setting, you can take all these pieces out and plug them someplace else.
Sure, but I'm just confused about the separation between stuff that calls into the DIX and stuff that calls into the DDX. Because K-Drive is the only other DDX that actually really works, and even then it's really, really pointless.
Yeah, maybe I misunderstood what I was referring to. It's just maybe the abstraction between a driver level, low level functions, and anything that interfaces the above layers. Because you don't want to have DDX functionalities way down inside your bitbanging pieces. Because if you want to port it someplace else, you would have to change all those things. So yeah, I'm not sure if anybody would want to port this to K-Drive. I don't know what the status of K-Drive is at the moment. Is there anybody actually still working on it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Only on embedded.
Right.
Are you pleased with this effort and sort of really, really stupid devices that you don't know better?
Like, oh, like you guys have. Are you going to use API hardware or not?
No.
Okay.
I mean, you will be seeing more and more API, embedded. API hardware embedded in system chip across companies, and that will be probably targeted by K-Drive. It could be interesting to have those things, those cases, abstraction cases, be shared across different DSs.
I think what very few people know is that another strong area where API is pretty strong and is providing hardware for embedded device. John may have known more about this. John?
I'm not sure.
Oh, I'm not sure.